is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy. Wait a second. This is not Tom Hartman, but you are tuning in to the Tom Hartman Program. Danielle, me, and Shano sitting in for Tom today. So we hope that you will stick around and join us. Lots of big stories in the news, including the massive march in France.
World leaders showing up.
We have some interesting thoughts on that that we're going to get to. But we wanted to start with some domestic news, some very, very big news about Keystone. Of course, Congress managed to attack Social Security, bring about a new era of trickle-down economics in just a matter of days. So what would be their next step but to pass Keystone XL? Joining us now to talk about that is the one and only Dave Saldana, the producer and director of Pipe Lies Exposed. You can check that out at pipeliesexposed.org. Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Daniel.
So we had a lot of big Keystone news last week that was kind of pushed in the background with the Charlie Hebdo, national, international headlines. Not only did the House pass Keystone, but there was also another big story out of Nebraska. Can you explain that for us?
Sure. The Nebraska Supreme Court made a decision by essentially not making a decision. The case was brought by landowners in Nebraska who believed that the law that granted the governor and his appointees the authority to condemn property by eminent domain for TransCanada's use violated the state's constitution. The state constitution creates a public services commission that has authority to regulate common carriers. That's anything from a taxi cab to a trucking service to a pipeline. The lower courts had ruled that yes, this was a power grab, unconstitutional by the governor, and that the law was unconstitutional, went before the Nebraska Supreme Court, which heard the case late last year. And their decision came out on Friday that four out of the seven justices of the Supreme Court agreed with the landowners that, yes, this was a power grab, an unjustifiable usurpation of the Public Services Commission's authority. But because it dealt with a constitutional question, it required a supermajority of five justices.
Essentially blocking the use of eminent domain here would go against the Nebraska state constitution, they needed a supermajority of justices to vote against it. Is that, do I have that correct? Is that double negatives?
It's not quite right. It required a supermajority because of the fact that it dealt with it with constitutional authority, not necessarily that it dealt with eminent domain or the governor's authority, but because it was a question between two constitutional authorities, that being the governor and the Public Services Commission.
So as it stands now, the Nebraska route for the pipeline is back on. It's back in the works. And a lot of members of the House of Representatives are saying that this took away President Obama's final, to use their words, excuse to block Keystone XL. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it was a legitimate reason. It was no excuse. It was a legitimate reason for the State Department to withhold its decision, because while that case was being adjudicated, there was no legal route through Nebraska. You can't approve a hypothetical pipeline, right? It needs to have a definitive route that the State Department can assess is either not good for the environment or acceptable risk to the environment. And while that case held the pipeline route in limbo, the State Department couldn't do anything about it. But that gets me to another very interesting point, that the case is still in the pipeline is still in limbo because there is now presently no legal route through the state of South Dakota.
Because of the permit there.
Right. The TransCanada received a permit applied for a permit in 2010, and it was approved. But in the intervening 5 years, that permit has expired. Now, in September, TransCanada resubmitted the same permit, and as of last week, the Public Utilities Commission of the state of South Dakota said denied the appeal by four Native American tribes and several environmental groups who said we would like to see them submit a new permit because they have changed so many factors of their original permit. Last week, the Public Utilities Commission of South Dakota said, no, we have to allow them to try to justify their previous permit or it would be a violation of due process. Now, I'm a lawyer, and I firmly believe in the states being required to allow due process, but I find it hard to believe or hard to fathom that having a permit that expires gives you a property right to having that same permit. That would be the due process that the state says that TransCanada is entitled to.
Yeah, but that's a new one. If you ask me, I want to quickly just remind everybody, we're speaking with Dave Saldana, the producer and director of Pipe Lies Exposed, which you could check out at pipeliesexposed.org. And there's so much information on that website about Keystone and about the misinformation that's been put out there. And sorry, Dave, go ahead.
Well, a lot of the misinformation that we debunked in Keystone Pipe Lies Exposed has come around again. We're seeing that in the House of Representatives, where they took their vote last week, they're throwing around a number of 42,000 jobs.
Right.
That was debunked a long time ago. Sorry.
Do you need to get that, Dave?
No, there's a delivery at the door in my
dog. Okay. That's live radio.
That's live radio. Yeah,
he's just a stereotype in a lot of ways, that dog.
Yes, just to rehash what Dave was just saying there while his dog makes a radio appearance, is that the House of Representatives is throwing out this 42,000 jobs number again. Once again, after Dave, as you so eloquently put it, you disproved quite well. Just out of curiosity, why, even if this absurd claim was true, 42,000 jobs, that's fewer jobs than the U.S. creates in a week. So why could this even be called an infrastructure bill, a jobs bill, as apparently that's the new nickname for it?
Yeah, it's kind of ludicrous, really. And as you mentioned, the government numbers indicate that more than a half more than 50,000 jobs are created every week, and that's on a typical month. You know, we're looking at these 42,000 jobs as if they're a godsend, when in fact there are temporary jobs. If that number is in fact true, they are only temporary jobs, the secondary and tertiary jobs that are created to supply the pipeline, to feed the workers, etc. But we've already discussed that's just a 2-year set.
Yeah.
At most, it's 2 years during construction.
Right. And in December alone, the businesses service sector produced 52,000 jobs. So this is one of the Republicans' favorite claims. And it, like so many others, is a bunch of nonsense. Dave, so much to talk about here. Any chance you would like to stick around?
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
Great. We're going to run to a quick break. And we'll be back with more because there is so much to get into here on Keystone XL. And it has been pushed out of the media cycle, but not here. We're speaking with Dave Saldana. It's me, Danielle, and Shano in for Tom Hartman. And we'll be back with more. So stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Supermajority from the Supreme Court on constitutional issues. How would that change our federal Supreme Court? Interesting thought. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Shano and me, Danielle, standing in for Tom today. Tom will be back He is just out. But we are doing our best to fill in the meantime. Dave Saldana is still with us, producer and director of Pipe Lies Exposed, pipeliesexposed.org, where you can find out about just about every myth when it comes to Keystone. Dave, we were talking about the jobs numbers. This is the Republicans' favorite claim when it comes to Keystone. You had some additional thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, first off, that 42,000 number that they've been trotting out lately is actually lower than the 120,000 that they were trotting out before. So we are reeling them back towards reality. But in fact, we know that even by the highest estimates in the State Department, we're looking at possibly 35 to 50 permanent jobs at the end of the day. But what's really fascinating about this is that the Republicans in the House who have been throwing around this 42,000 jobs number that will happen if we approve this pipeline are now acknowledging for the first time in about 40 years that demand creates jobs. Right?
Right.
It's the exact opposite of their trickle-down economics theory that if you give rich people more money, they'll create more jobs. Well, it doesn't work out that way. What we know is that if there are jobs in the system, if people are getting paid, that creates more jobs. So that's an incredible tacit admission by the Republicans that their entire economic philosophy is just wrong.
Yeah, it's funny how they often have to admit the truth on that theory. But speaking of demand, one thing that has piqued my curiosity regarding Keystone recently are oil prices. As oil prices continue to drop, let's face it, even those of us who know very little about tar sands and the extraction process, I have to imagine that as oil prices drop, it's just not cost effective to extract tar sands and to carry all this risk for the dirtiest, most dangerous type of oil that we have available. How can they continue to justify this project with oil prices as low as they are?
Well, that's a very important point. The State Department assessment figured that they needed somewhere between $65 and $75 per barrel as the low mark. Now we've got oil trickling in at under $50 a barrel at times.
Right, and Goldman Sachs saying it could drop to 30 before it hits bottom.
Yeah, it's what we're looking at there is that it's simply not cost effective for them to put tar sands oil on the market. They would actually be losing money if the price is below $65. That was the absolute floor that the State Department set. But what we learn is that they're not banking on today's oil prices. They're banking on tomorrow's. The price is going to go up eventually. At some point, it's going to go back up again, and they're going to be the ones to rake that in. You know, it's classic shock doctrine, as Naomi Wolf put it. You know, they buy when the market is at the bottom because they know it's going back up again.
Yeah, well, they certainly can. So as it stands now, the Keystone XL has passed a Senate committee. It's I believe going to be the debate on Keystone is going to start in the Senate today and then theoretically on to the president's desk. I know that in past interviews with me, with Tom, on various shows, you have been all about getting people involved and helping them stand up against Keystone. What can we do at this point?
Well, at this point, we know that the House has already passed it. But I hate to predict anything that happens in Washington.
Of course.
It seems to me that this is a dead letter already. The House passed it with the additional votes of 28 House Democrats. That gave it the majority it needed, the simple majority it needed to pass the House. But the majority it requires to get past a veto, to override a veto, they would need an additional at least 15 more Democrats. Now, the Democrats ran away from President Obama in this last election. And we see where it got them.
Right.
So I don't see 15 Democrats who voted no changing their minds to vote yes. So I think that it's already a dead letter. Now, in terms of the Senate, we're looking at a pretty good Republican majority, but again, not enough to override a veto. They still need that 2/3. But once again, the argument is that a narrow victory is the same as a narrow loss in a lot of ways. So you want to to produce as much public support for those members of Congress in both the House and the Senate who say, no, we don't want this pipeline, right? We want to give them as much political cover as we possibly can, so they don't have to answer those questions in 2 years or 6 years or 4 years, whenever their term is up, saying, why did you vote down that jobs program?
And the same, I would think, goes for President Obama. This may be the first veto of this, Republicans in control of Congress next 2 years, but it very well may not be the last. And I think standing with him on this decision might help him pull out that veto pen again in the future over the next 2 years, if needed. Any thoughts really quickly?
Sure. The president has telegraphed that he's not going to sign this bill. And in fact, the spokesperson for the White House said in no uncertain terms last week, he's going to veto this bill. So what we're going through now is strictly kabuki theater. It's Republicans puffing out their chests and saying, we own the Congress. And then we've got the president who's saying, that doesn't matter. I've got the veto pen. So if we can give the president and the Democrats in Congress who are opposed to this bill, who are opposed to Keystone XL, as much political cover as we can to let them know that you have the votes in your home district in across the nation to stand with you and say, no, we don't want this toxic slurry running through our nation's breadbasket.
Yep.
We've got the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, saying that the only people who oppose Keystone XL are fringe extremists. Those are his words, fringe extremists.
Dave, I wouldn't consider you a fringe extremist, and I certainly wouldn't consider myself or the millions of people listening to this show fringe extremists either. Dave, thank you so much for joining us and for breaking this all down, helping us talk back to the Keystone lies. We really appreciate it.
Always here. Always glad to be here, Daniel.
Dave Saldana, producer-director of Pipe Lies Exposed. Check out the movie and get the facts at pipeliesexposed.org. Danielle Enchaino, in for Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And since Tom's out, we can do an unofficial Anything Goes. What's on your mind? 202-536-3270. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Shano and me, Danielle, sitting in for Tom today. Shano.
I know, a half hour, not a word from me.
I know, you're very quiet over there.
Well, I don't like to interrupt, especially when you have guests on.
Yeah. There is so much to cover today, and we are going to get back to the Keystone stuff if anybody wants to talk about it.
Well, but that slips under the radar. When you have huge international events like this going on, and they're important international events.
Yes.
Real questions about speech and about liberty, about freedom, and about so-called wars on terror.
And about unity.
Equally big, I think, is the potential destruction of the heartland of our country with toxic sludge. And Republicans love to slip those types of things under the radar.
Right.
Although I would argue that they're doing this vote today not to pass Keystone. This is a purely political move.
Right.
What everyone learned from the last election was that Americans are angry at gridlock. Now, Republicans have been responsible for gridlock up until this point. But they've got to figure out a way to shift that blame, or at least keep it away from themselves, over to the president. They know the president's going to veto this. They have control of the Congress. They have the House. They have the Senate. They pass this, and they say, see, he's the problem. Republicans are great at politics. They're lousy at governing. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's my little rant on it.
Fair enough. And all of it is manipulated by the media, which the Republicans have a tendency to sometimes be a little better at that manipulation.
Well, they also get a lot more airtime. Watch any of the Sunday shows. We did right. This. We finally watched them. We broke down yesterday.
And, of course, the Sunday shows this week were all about Charlie Hebdo and Paris and world leaders marching together with thousands of protesters. And they even
because
had
it was
happening
live during the morning shows because of the time difference. They had the live pictures.
Right. And they even had this amazing picture of 30 world leaders. You know, it looks like they're marching in front of a crowd of thousands.
It was amazing. I was flabbergasted to see Netanyahu and Abbas. I mean, a few people away, arm in arm. I was like, this is great.
Right. It's
this
an amazing picture. And the media was asking, where is Biden? Where is President Obama?
Yeah.
And we both, even though we are well-versed in these type of questions and this type of quote-unquote journalism, we both fell for it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, like,
yeah,
where,
that's a really good idea. Well, though, the security concern.
Right.
You really, you know, the way the Secret Service works, and I don't know this for a fact, but I've seen this in interviews with former Secret Service people. You don't debate with the Secret Service whether you're going to go someplace. Right. Even as the president, you know, say, well, they'll say, Mr. President, you're going through this door. It's not like you say, well, no, I want to go through that one. It's, Mr. President, you're going to go through this door.
Right.
The stories of Dick Cheney being dragged off on 9/11. That you're not the commander in chief at that moment because the Secret Service is going to protect you. So the Secret Service may have said, Mr. President, Mr. Vice President, Secretary of State, you are not going to Paris.
However,
and they could say why, and we're not telling you, but you're not going.
Right. However, that picture that seemed show world leaders marching in front of a crowd of thousands and leading these unity protests was completely staged.
It was.
So it would have been nothing but the president or Biden going there for a photo op. At least that's how it would have been painted.
You have to go over to Democratic Underground to see this picture because there's the shot we all saw, eye level. You know, this is the, you know, perspective of propaganda where you see just at eye level and you can see all these heads behind the world leaders. Like, this is gigantic. They're leading this march. And then you see the above shot that's over at DU.
And I'm just curious what people listening thought about this. First of all, should Biden or Obama have been there regardless?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, should international events with this much importance be manipulated like this to be a photo op, or should politicians be there actually working on issues? Perhaps
I will say
people
that
have some opinions on that.
There is no doubt that those complaining, those that always complain whatever Barack Obama does, if he had gone, it would have been, well, why is he spending whatever $6 billion a day to go to Paris when he should be working on fighting terrorism here at home?
There's a certain level of darned if you do, darned if you don't.
Yeah, if he walked on water, they complain he couldn't swim, that old saying. So they are going to complain no matter what. But there is a real question when it comes to world solidarity and standing up for freedom and speech and all that. Should he have been there even for a photo op?
Yeah, that's fine.
You know,
sometimes showing solidarity is in of itself valuable.
I think it can be.
I agree. So, just as you said, the power of that picture of certain world leaders who, you know, don't often get photographed together, showing that they want to come together to find a way past exclusion and extremism, because one leads to the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't get rid of extremism until you stop excluding people.
Right.
So, but we do have a lot of people on hold who also want to talk about the Keystone. This is a big issue affecting a lot of people. So I would like to go to Jennifer listening on Sirius in Pierre, South Dakota. Jennifer, is that the correct pronunciation?
It's actually pronounced Pierre.
Pierre.
Pierre, South Dakota. Yeah, it's the state capital. I am in a unique situation where I'm actually born and raised in Nebraska, and for the last 8 years have lived in South Dakota. And to just lay it out there, I am not well educated on the Keystone, even being from both states that it's involved in.
That's okay.
But I know enough. Thank you. I know enough to, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And I've done enough fact checking to see it's not something that I want here. However, in laying aside any of the environmental issues of it, which are vast, nobody's talking about the rights of the landowners.
Right. Well,
and the people around here that own the ranches, own the farms, these are passed down from generation to generation. They have a right to say what they want and what they don't want on their land.
Absolutely.
And nobody's saying or giving their rights any more value. But if you take my guns, I have that right to have that gun, but I don't have a right to say what's on my land and what's not.
Mm.
Well, that's actually what this case in Nebraska was about, whether the governor had the right to come in and essentially take these people's land for the purpose of an international corporation to sell oil in other countries, essentially.
Right.
So that was what the case at hand was in Nebraska, but you're right. It did get kind of lost in the discussion there.
Yeah, and this comes down to, you know, eminent domain. In the Constitution, the government may take property with just compensation for a governmental purpose. And long ago, the Supreme Court, not that long ago, a few years ago, in the, I think it was the Kelo case or the Lido case.
Kelo.
The city of New London, Connecticut, said that the government can take the land from a person, give them just compensation, which usually is pretty lousy. It's really not just. And then turn that land over to a for-profit corporation, like they did in the city of New London. And that's what they're doing here. Now, they were challenging this not under the United States Constitution, but under the Nebraska Constitution. And you had a majority of the judges on that court saying, yeah, we find this unconstitutional.
Right, four out of seven.
But because there's this quirk in their state constitution that says when the Supreme Court is making a ruling here in the state of Nebraska on the Nebraska Constitution, you need a supermajority. You need five justices, which seems incredible to me. But that's what happened. This was about landowners' rights here.
Right. And, you know, and I think they just pick and choose what they find is to be justice or to be right. Because, you know, the people who have right to bear arms is way more valuable because maybe it's, I don't know, more of a moneymaker for them, I imagine. I just find it kind of sad for these landowners, you know, and once that pipeline goes in, the land that they have above it is probably rendered useless. I can't imagine they can graze cows on it anymore, and I can't imagine that they can grow anything on it anymore. And what if that's all their land?
Right.
I just find it.
And the fact is, it doesn't matter if it's a small percentage of their land. It's their land, and they don't want a foreign corporation building an oil pipeline through it. And it would be one thing if this served a legitimate government interest, as if the government needs to build a road, a school, an airport. There are situations where eminent domain is used, and it's, while maybe still unjust, it's understandable. This is not one of them for me.
I think it raised an interesting point, though. What about putting the Fifth Amendment together with the Second Amendment? You have a right to own a gun, but we're going to take it and give you just compensation for your guns.
Well, Jennifer could be onto something, but that's not surprising. Tom's listeners, always the smartest in the world. Jennifer, I'm going to move along real quickly if we have time for one more.
We do.
All right, let's go with Scott. And Jennifer, thank you for listening on Sirius and for sharing your opinion. Scott in Scottsdale, Arizona. Listening on Sirius. Thanks for calling in today. Scott? No Scott. All right. Let's go with Michael in Boulder, Colorado, watching on Free Speech TV. Michael?
Hey, good morning, Danielle.
Good morning.
And Shane. Kudos to Jennifer there. She said in some ways what I wanted to say, but basically, this situation with the XL pipeline leads me, as a former teacher at one time and teaching history, that this is a great lesson for reviving and really for everyone, not just school kids, learning about your local civics and how that projects out and projects back to your community from, Washington. I'm an oldster. I'm like Tom. And I remember where it was mandatory that when you were basically in middle school.
Learning civics.
To learn about your local government, about civics, about how rules are made.
We are out of time, but I think you make an excellent point. Oftentimes when our government isn't functioning correctly, is the best opportunity to learn how it's supposed to function. We'll be back with more. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What do you think? Is this a good opportunity to learn about civics? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, you want me to make that argument
out
loud?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, yes. Oftentimes we learn about our civics and how things work after our property rights are in jeopardy or after our liberties in jeopardy. We often learn, many people learn about the criminal justice system after they're part of it.
Yes, unfortunately.
Sometimes it's more useful to learn a little before, if possible. And I think that's what the last caller was talking about, in that we should be teaching this at a young level through school, making a mandatory class so that people understand how these things work.
I think it's...
And it also makes you more likely to go out to vote.
Right.
And you find out what the government
important.
Can do to you.
But I think these, regardless of whether it being too late that we should have learned about it earlier, these issues that take on the national media, that make it into every household, and and that lots of people are sitting around dinner tables discussing, like Keystone, because it's quite possible to have a variety of viewpoints, often depending on where you get your news, on the Keystone XL pipeline. It's a good opportunity to say, hey, what happened in the House? What happened in the Senate? You know, how many votes does it need for the Senate to override a veto? Very
sure.
good civics
yeah,
lessons to
that's a
teach
idea.
Our family members, to teach our children.
I like that. I consider this show a civics lesson every day.
Well, we are lucky enough to work in a civics lesson.
Yeah.
Let's go with Wayne in Jacksonville, Illinois, watching on Free Speech TV. Wayne, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to get something off my chest that's been bothering me since this Charlie massacre in Paris.
And okay.
It's occurred to me that this is not a free speech issue unless the authorities are involved in suppressing or killing those people or putting them out of business or something like that. That what we're up against here is law of human nature, if for want of a better term. The fact is that there are people who aren't necessarily career criminals who walk around the world on the verge of violence. And how can I put it? It's very hard to protect anyone from those people for whatever reason, but it's very hard to protect anyone from those people if they insist upon mocking them and insulting them.
Yeah, Wayne, I think you make a couple valid points here, if I may, just to clarify, to see if I'm understanding correctly. It's not a free speech issue because the government isn't suppressing
a First Amendment issue. He said free speech. I think he means
right.
First Amendment.
Is that what you're getting at? Separate
yes,
of
yes, which yeah. technically whichever it is, and it's probably different in France
right.
than
right.
the States. But,
right. Right. And then the other portion being that this is a small minority. In fact, only 2%. There's an article over at Think Progress. Only 2% of all terrorist attacks in Europe have to do with religion. It's a very small group of people, as you're saying, who are going around perpetrating violence. Did I gather that correctly?
As a white guy, I could walk into any impoverished.
Wayne, I'm sorry, we're going to be out of time. I apologize. That was my fault. We'll be back with more here on the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Shano and me, Danielle, sitting in for Tom today. If you want to hang out with us off air, you can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at Danielle on Radio, and Shano over there is Producer Shano.
That's correct.
If you have comments that you would like to, feedback, criticism.
I usually get great tweets in the middle of the show from callers saying, hey, you should look here.
Yes.
And I do.
Yes.
I actually do.
Shano is probably more responsive on a regular basis on that kind of stuff just because I'm a little busy during the show.
Yeah.
Yes, but we have lots more in store today, including lots more great calls here. I wanted to get to a friend of ours I see on the board here, Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Paul, you sent me a letter that I meant to print out on the last break, and I haven't had a chance, but regarding the Social Security Disability Insurance Program cuts that the Republicans enacted via the Rules Committee. Is that what your comment is about today?
Right. Right. I wanted to, there was mentioned at the bottom of the hour, Tom Hartman news segment but there's more to this. This is a dastardly, a devious, stunt that the Republicans in the House of Representatives have pulled. Just to explain it briefly, that it is a rules change. The Social Security Disability Trust Fund, which is just like Social Security, is for disabled people. It basically is SSDI is what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Is like collecting Social Security. Once you've worked for a minimum period of 10 full years, it's like you're being eligible for Social Security, the minimum amount. And if you become disabled, you're eligible for that. Well, it's a different fund. It's a separate fund from the Social Security Trust Fund. And it needs to be reallocated or replenished every so often. So it's kind of on an as-needed basis because there are, you know, there are different numbers of disabled people throughout the decades. Okay, so this has to be done periodically. And, of course, all revenue transfers and so on have to come start through the House of Representatives. And the House of Representatives passed a rule that says last week, the first day of Congress, of the 114th Congress, that they will not allow themselves to transfer these funds unless a bill. So this is not a bill. This is not something that Obama can veto. It's a rules thing in the House. They will not consider transferring these funds unless a bill is passed and signed by the president into law that would make cuts to Social Security, general Social Security. In other words, they are after you too, and they're holding me hostage.
Right.
This SSDI fund was set to run out next year, and they are going to cut this in order to keep it until it runs out totally, cut benefits to disabled people who have worked for these benefits by 20%. For me, that means subsisting on a puny of about $1,080 a month. 20% less would be $864 a month.
Right, and it brings to mind, first and foremost for me, Paul, is what kind of person starts their cuts on the backs of the disabled?
Yeah.
Who gets this idea in their head and says that this is a good place to start cutting, regardless of what you think of the budget, where you think it should be?
And Paul, correct me if I'm wrong here, the difference between these two funds is essentially the account number. The money comes from the same place. It's allocated on a percentage basis, and they just have different account numbers. I mean, they're called different things, but it's just a different bank account. Is it right? Am I right?
It's just like your checking account and your savings account.
Right.
They're the same.
Right.
And this has been done 11 times since 1950 without incident, without it ever being a scandal. And it's just now where they want to tinker with the main Social Security program. They want to get their hands on it, mm-hmm. privatize it. And so what better way than to put disabled people on the
brink? Right. And I will tell you, if it were the reverse, if the disabled fund was flush with money for the next 19 years and the main account were going to be going down in 2016, they would have done it the other way. They just want to force that crisis as soon as possible while they're in control.
Well, maybe not, Shano, because, you know, when you're messing with just 11 million disabled people who really don't have a lot of power versus, say, 80 or 90 million retirees who are going to go, wait a minute.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's kind of like picking on, it's picking on, you know, really, would you stand by, ladies and gentlemen, would you stand by and watch a disabled person, a blind person, or someone in a wheelchair be attacked on the street? Would you?
Right.
Because that's
absolutely
what's
not
going on now. And if you do that, let me tell you something. Your neighborhood is no safer for that, and they will. Those people, those muggers who are beating up that blind person or that wheelchair person are going to be after you next, and they are. And let me tell you something. Here's the four things that they want to cut. The first thing they want to do is cut your benefits. That's the first thing. The next thing they want to do is they want to raise the age of retirement, mm-hmm. which, by the way, when you think about it, if they raise it to 70, the puny benefit that they're going to cut to me means I have to stay on that until I'm actually eligible for regular Social Security. That's 5 more years. You see? Okay. Then they want to, of course, the chain CPI. That's the other thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they want means testing. Those are the four things that they want to do to your Social Security. You need to call John Boehner's office and tell them that this is outrageous, and you also need to flood this moron teabagger from New York by the name of Tom Reed. Tom Reed, call Tom Reed and ask him, why do you hate disabled people? What did they ever do to you? Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not the enemy. I'm just a normal, patriotic, middle-of-the-road American, okay? And I worked and I suffered the loss of my eyesight to a disease that is incurable.
Paul, the one thing about the disabled is many of them have some free time. And I certainly hope that whether it requires them to borrow a friend's phone, go to a public library, as may be because of their financial status, that they get on the phone and start ringing everybody they know to call Congress. The congressional switchboard number is 202-225-3121. Let them know, let John Boehner know that you're not going to stand for budget cuts on the backs of the disabled. We shouldn't even have to be having this conversation. That's why I knew Paul would have an epic rant on it.
The good news is, though, if they can make this rule with a majority vote, they can change this rule with a majority vote.
Yes, they can.
So our calls will have an effect. They can have an effect, and they can be reversed.
Right, and you know what? Call Tom Reed, but also call every single member of Congress and see where they stand and, you know, figure out who stands with and who stands against the disabled. It should be a pretty clear-cut question. We're going to be coming back with Lee Camp of Redacted Tonight to talk about free speech and political satire. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Shano and me, Danielle, sitting in for Tom today. Of course, the huge story that everybody's been talking about is the Charlie Hebdo attacks and how they affect free speech. I have seen all different varieties of responses to these attacks and whether free speech should be considered, whether it should be all or nothing, whether it should be, you know, judged by law, by society, including different articles that I have here from Alternet and from David Brooks in the New York Times, both saying I am not Charlie Hebdo. So it's a little difficult to make sense of all these different viewpoints. So I thought it might be best to speak to a political satirist himself, Lee Camp, comedian, host of Redacted Tonight on RT and on YouTube.com/Redacted Tonight. Also the creator of Moment of Clarity podcast, which you can check out on Hulu. And you can view his website, LeeCamp.net. Lee, where do you stand on this? There are just so many different viewpoints. It seems like everybody's trying to put a flag in their individual perspective and not really considering the big picture here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this should be that arguable. I think that we should stand up for free speech, no matter how offensive you find it. And then if it's, you know, some of those, one of those articles I read, I think it was Vaughn Cole saying, I am not Charlie Hebdo. He was talking about how various positions at universities were lost or newspapers at universities were shut down because of things that were printed. And it's like, well, that's different. That is an organization. I mean, I think the students should have a say in that, but I think that's an organization saying we don't want this. Different. That's different than legally, you know, you're not allowed to do this. I think legally we should be allowed to say whatever we want, and I would stand up for the right of the KKK to have a Klan newsletter if they wanted to their own people. But, you know, that's the test of freedom of speech. Is it something you're offended by? Do you still stand up for it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're referring to the David Brooks one, which I think he made a lot of great points, but he worked way too hard trying to cram an ideology into those points by essentially making the same point you are, that it shouldn't be governed by law, that it should be up to you as an individual whether or not you read a particular book or magazine or whether or not you support a particular form of speech, but then somehow working that into, as you said, in not so many words, universities not letting Condoleezza Rice give commencement speeches, which we all know is what is implied there.
Right. That's an organization or the students of that organization deciding they don't want, you know, someone to speak. That's different than saying that person can't speak out on a sidewalk. You know, it's like when people like to yell at me, you know, if they put hate speech on my Facebook and I delete it and they go, oh, what happened to freedom of speech? And I'm like, no, I believe in your freedom of speech to say it on a sidewalk. That doesn't mean I need to allow hate speech on my Facebook page.
Right. And yourself, as somebody who often says things some people might consider controversial, not me personally, but hey, some people might come to that conclusion. They don't have to watch your show. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't still support your right
to say
that. Yes,
they do have
to
watch his show, actually.
Well, they might learn something, but that's beside the point. Am I getting the gist of your point there correctly, Lee?
Yeah, they can turn it off. I mean, I'm trying to get a bill through Congress now that would require people to watch my show, but other than that.
The Lee Camp Requirement Act?
I'd co-sponsor that.
So, you know, as a society, we might decide there are things that are distasteful and that we don't want to say in common conversation, but shouldn't that same society work to make sure that if you're the jerk that wants to say them, you can?
Right. And you know, sometimes people will, they get offended by something a comedian said on stage and they'll try and, you know, make sure some other thing they're involved in, like, say, a sitcom separately, that they get fired from it. And I think that often depends on context of what was said. Sometimes people hear one sentence from a comedian on stage that goes viral, and they never listen to the context of the thing. That doesn't mean – I am often offended by some of the things that are argued about in our discourse. You know, oh, this comedian said this thing. Is it offensive? Often the answer is yes, but I just hope people take context into consideration, because it is very different. You know, Louis C.K., if you watch his full hour, can say just about anything because he's created a persona where you know who he is, you know what he means, and rarely, even if the sentence is offensive, do you think, oh, he means that. And so that's why you have to take context into account.
Well, context, and as somebody, you know, who you do stand-up, you have a television show. Can you imagine there being any restrictions, any limitations on the things that you're allowed or not allowed to say?
No, I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm at RT America is because they don't have commercials, and therefore I can go after all the corporations that I feel are destroying our lives, and on a lot of networks you can't. So, you know, in that way, the more brutal kind of censorship I feel in our society is who they choose to be on certain networks. You know, like, certain networks are simply not going to pick someone that criticizes Obama or doesn't criticize Obama, or, you know, they're picking people that fit in a very small box of thought. And if you go after the corporations that are paying for the advertising, then they're not going to have you there.
So how do we protect free speech and still, you know, how do we protect people's lives? Should a news organization have the right, as AP, as other organizations, pulled down specific pictures, specific graphics? Should they have the right to protect their journalists, even at the expense of free speech?
Well, I'll let an organization speak for themselves. If they feel threatened, then I guess that's their choice of what to publish. I mean, there's a lot of things that organizations choose not to publish because it would just harm too many people, such as, you know, certain kinds of dead bodies and things like that. So I think that is a choice they're allowed to make. But, you know, when people say, oh, we've got to do all these things because these cartoonists were killed, well, okay, I got an idea. Let's make killing illegal. Oh, that's right. We already have that. We already, like, you know, when something like this happens, I think it's important not to overreact.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think about the unity marches and this massive massive showing of people standing together in the name of free speech?
Well, I think that's great. I mean, I think people need to think about this, but I wish they would also think about what I was talking about earlier about, you know, stuff that's not technically censored, but that our news channels, our media are not showing us, so that our thoughts are kind of censored in that there's a whole array of understanding and thoughts and ideas that are basically not allowed on these media networks in a larger way. And like, people need to think as much about that as they need to think about, well, this one cartoon wasn't aired because they decided to censor it.
Yeah, and I think that those thoughts that do end up censored could go a long way in towards making actual unity instead of, you know, symbolic gestures, but that's just my opinion.
Absolutely.
Lee, so Redacted Tonight, you want to give a quick shout-out, get people to tune in of what's coming up?
Yeah, I mean, we try and cover all those things I've been talking about, all these things that don't seem to get covered in the mainstream media. We've done a lot on the most censored stories of 2014 since it was just the new year, and I hope people check it out. It's every week. It's on Friday nights we air. We're kind of like Colbert, except more edgy maybe in a certain sense. And it's every week, youtube.com/redactedtonight. You can also watch it there on RT America or on Hulu.
I would say that's a very fair description. And if you haven't seen Lee Camp stand up, you should check that out as well. Go over to leecamp.net and find out where you may see some really amazing political comedy and satire. Lots more in store. What are your thoughts on where, if any, there should be lines on free speech? You're listening to Danielle and Chano. Thank you very much, Lee.
Thanks.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Should there be any limits? Should the name of harmony in the community be greater than your ability to say what you want? And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. This is the free speech break. So let's go to Bill in Dayton, Ohio. Bill, you wanted to discuss Keystone. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Thank you. This is Bill, Dayton, Ohio. I know a lot of our history keeps repeating itself. And out of ominousness, I went and printed out the other night. I couldn't understand what Nebraska was talking about. And I printed out all the rulings and everything that's going on. What I feel in my heart is, again, the American Indian is having treaties thrown out the window again by our federal government.
Oh, yeah.
What the governor was wanting to do is do eminent domain. Well, I have about 60 pages here from the court filing.
Yeah, well, Bill, we certainly don't have time to read 60 pages. Can you give us a quick summary?
Yeah. Yes. The governor in a special session in 2011 passed a law in Nebraska called LV 1161, and it was giving them dominion over public use, like you would railroads, you would do highways, things along that line. But what it came across as these people suing over their properties, the ruling came down that this group called RCS, what it means is the group that answers to the governor is the group for the governor, and the guys that fought against it state that if it crosses more than one state, each state should have the right to fight this. And Nebraska is second out of many states it crosses. So that's another ground. But what comes across is they changed the name from Trans-America Proposed Keystone XL Crude Pipeline for hire. And they sent money to the environment of $12 billion system. Is 80% prescribed in a binding contract.
Okay, Bill, I don't mean to cut you off here, but we only we have less than a minute left of this segment. Where are you going with this?
I'd say, as American citizens, I enjoyed watching the Indians and the Cowboys go all the way to D.C. and stand there, and Congress and the president didn't pay no attention to them. And a lot of us should just stand up and say, hey, no pipeline. No dumping oil in our water, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most important point is that people stand up regardless of what the issue is. You know, when we're talking about unity and free speech, like we're talking to Lee Camp about, where you're talking about Keystone, whether you're talking about Social Security and cuts to disability, if we don't get up and get active, as Tom would say, we only have ourselves to blame.
Yeah, and I think Dave made a great point that when the president has to veto this, which it seems likely this is going to happen, to stand behind him. Those who are opposed to the pipeline, stand behind the president, because he's going to take a lot of heat.
Yes.
And he shouldn't be taking it alone, because he's doing it really for us and for the breadbasket of our country.
Exactly. And, you know, for future generations. So somebody's got to stand up. I know there's lots that we disagree with the president on, but he needs our support on this one if there's any chance of stopping that final leg of Keystone XL. So lots more in store. Let us know what your thoughts are. Keystone, France, free speech. Let us know. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. Tom is out today, but Shano and me, Danielle.
And Tom is fine.
Tom is fine.
He will tell you all about it when he gets back.
Yes. But we are filling in, having some fun joining you guys here today. You know, just talking about all the major stories that are in the news or not in the news enough.
And Lee made a really interesting point that while there's no government intrusion in saying you can't say this, that the corporate control of the media is a form of censorship. And I think it's a really interesting point we haven't talked about. And you don't see a lot of people locking arms around the world to combat that. You know, that is happening on a daily basis.
Well,
and there's a lot of places where you're not going to hear about, you know, the real answers to Keystone. You're not going to hear about net neutrality.
And you're not going to hear about real impacts, real attacks on free speech.
Right.
You know, at the exact same time where, you know, world leaders were meeting in Paris to talk about unity and protect free speech in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
A journalist, forgive me for mispronouncing this name, as I'm sure I will, Raif Badawi, was being flogged. And his only crime? Freedom of expression.
He was a blogger, you know, was he not?
Yes. Right. He created a website for public discussion. But he has been sentenced to 10 years in prison, 1,000 lashes, and a fine of the equivalent of about $260,000.
Well, we may be pointing at Saudi Arabia here, but let's talk
it happens
about
all over the world.
Let's talk about James Risen and Edward Snowden, and the only person who's in prison over the CIA torture,
John Kiriakou.
John Kiriakou, and those are situations in which our own country. No, our own country is not shooting down people in a building.
Right.
But they are imprisoning and taking the liberty of people for speaking out, for whistleblowing. There are attacks on our speech all the time.
Right. And I'm sorry, David Brooks, but somebody being disinvited.
You should explain David Brooks's.
Yeah.
You know, I know you referred to it because you're in the middle of an interview.
There's
so
New York Times op-ed by David Brooks called I Am Not Charlie Hebdo, and he writes, the journalists at Charlie Hebdo are now rightly being celebrated as martyrs on behalf of freedom of expression, but let's face it, if they had tried to publish their satirical newspaper on any American university campus over the last two decades, it wouldn't have lasted 30 seconds.
Right, and if you stop right there, when I read that, I said, you know what, he's got a point, but what he draws from this is that a community, a society, a smaller part of our society, a community, a college campus, putting forward definitions of what things are acceptable to us as a community is far different than the type of censorship that's going on when extremists come in and shoot up a building.
Right.
And his conclusion here is that we shouldn't have laws that limit speech, and I agree with that, that society itself and communities can decide for themselves. The FCC does this every day. There is no list of words that the FCC says you cannot say on the radio. It's community standards. You know, we know the obvious ones. But it's up to a society to decide for itself and individual consumers to decide for themselves, not laws. But he goes on to essentially, you know, complain about speakers at universities getting disinvited. But that's a community deciding. And
right.
I think that's where those decisions should be made.
Right. And they're coming together, exercising their, you know, their ability, their free speech in saying, I don't want this person to represent me. I think that is vastly different than the government or even society as a whole coming out you know, and saying you can't say this in the public sphere.
Right.
You can't publish this newspaper. You can't have this discussion. You can't hold this march. Those are very different determinations than saying you can't, you know, rake in $100,000 or whatever the fee may be to give a commencement speech.
Right.
I think these are very different concepts, and trying to link the two, I think weakens the argument.
Yes. But then you do have what Lee was talking about. You do have other forces that are causing us to self-censor.
Yes.
You have the threat of violence, and you have international news organizations saying, I'm not going to republish these comics, these cartoons, for fear that some of our foreign correspondents may put in harm's way. So there is a self-censoring going on. The question has been asked, you know, why didn't every newspaper the next day in solidarity publish these cartoons that are found to be offensive by many in the Islamic religion? Why did you not, as a sign of solidarity and that we will, you know, respect liberty and freedom of expression, all that, publish these? And many places did not. And the far-right zealots, many of them are saying, oh, you wimps. But I can understand both sides of that. I like to ask that question. Do you think that the Washington Post, the New York Times, all of them should have published these cartoons as a sign of solidarity for free speech?
Yeah, I'd love to hear what listeners have to say. I know where I stand on it, but I don't want to put...
Where do you stand on?
Well, I don't think that they should have.
I think it's
unless
their own decision.
Right, unless they wanted to. But I don't think they should have had to.
Nor should they be excoriated for not.
Right. To me, it's not some test that that they don't really believe in free speech unless they're willing to print an offensive cartoon. I don't think that that's the line for me. Mm-hmm. I certainly would never repost or print literature that the KKK puts out.
Right.
Would never do it. But I would still support their right to gather and hold an event and release that publication. Morally, ethically, there is a part of me that will always wish that they didn't have that right, but I understand the importance, the principle of them.
The Nazis marching through Skokie. If I had a few minutes with them, I would say, this is a really bad idea. Please don't do this.
Right.
But at the ACLU, and I agree with, you have the right to. You have
but
the right
I also
to,
have
to
the right not
things.
To read it,
sure
not
do.
To be present.
Yes.
I have the right
and certainly
to
not to repeat it.
I have the right to protest
you
that
do.
Paper. I have the right to say I don't want that person to represent me in any way, any fashion, or to, you know, be a speaker at an event I'm attending.
Right.
It's just such an interesting discussion, and while I think... Without the freedom of expression,
we wouldn't be talking right now.
Right. We wouldn't be here right now. We wouldn't be able to say things like the fact that we don't want drone bombing done in our name. We don't want the Keystone XL pipeline built through our country. But that means that sometimes people can print offensive cartoons. So yes. Where do you stand on that? Feel free to give us a call. Let us know. Should society make that decision? Should it be made at all? Should anybody be allowed to say whatever they want, regardless of who is offended?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And if you don't want to call, you can let us know on Twitter. Danielle on radio and producer Shano. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Tom is out today, but he will be back. And Shano and me, Danielle, are filling in, taking your calls.
Yeah, I know we blathered with one. We blathered a lot, but we wanted to ask those questions, and we do want to hear your answer. But I had one more thing to add.
Okay.
Now, when you say something offensive, and I think we agreed that we certainly don't want the government deciding what is and isn't offensive. There are repercussions. There will be repercussions from say on me. But a thing that throws a little bit of a fly in the ointment is oftentimes there's also repercussions on the people around me.
Mm-hmm.
Think of yourself if you were the cop outside Charlie Hebdo, got killed.
Yeah.
Or he was a security guard. But, you know, law enforcement who has to protect you, they could be harmed by this. So it isn't as simple and cut and dry sometimes. For example, when the APs, it's not just the person who decides to republish that cartoon. It's also their foreign correspondents that could be in some war area that could be a target. So the repercussions can go beyond just the person themselves. So that makes it more difficult to make some of these decisions.
Yeah.
As we get people's input on what they think.
Yeah, it's certainly another factor to consider. So let's go with...
enough of me.
With Danette, watching in Hinesville, Georgia, listening to Sirius XM satellite radio. Danette, thanks so much for watching or listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Yes, hi. The point that you guys just made is one that I think is the most important. Whether they have the right to print cartoons like that, or whether the Klan has the right to meet, or the Black Panthers have a right to meet, is not the point. The point is, what impact are we having on the society at large? And when you have an attack where you have 17 people dead now because of some cartoon, and to me, we have to take more responsibility for what we say, for what we print, and for what we do. My motto is to treat people the way we want to be treated. And other examples of censorship are that the entire story is not being told of our history. We whitewash what happened with the Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
We whitewash what happened with African Americans. We whitewash the war in Iraq, we're seen as liberators, all of the jargon and the stuff that we can put on bumper stickers. I think in Colorado over last summer, in like August or September when school first started, I believe that there was a walkout at a high school where the school board was wanting to change the history curriculum and make it more patriotic.
Yeah, they wanted to remove any references to protests, which is hilarious.
Yeah,
and that just makes no sense. And so when our government tries to censor us, when people can't say what is the truth about a story at a news organization, whether it's MSNBC, CNN, or even my local news, if they're not telling the truth about something, then what is the point of them doing it? And it is a form of censorship. And I just find it crazy and in some ways hypocritical that it's one thing to stand in solidarity and say that we're not going to be afraid. But then the whole point of the satirical paper is to mock religion and to say that religious people are nuts, right? And like, they don't have a right to believe what they believe. So we're censoring each other all over the place. And it's a sad thing that those people were killed. And we also just have to be measured in what we say. And the best thing to do is do like you were taught in kindergarten and treat people the way you want to be treated.
Yeah,
that's how I see it.
See, I certainly understand and respect that position. I'll be honest, I'm having a very tough time determining where I stand on this, because I can see and completely understand how you feel and how you get to that point. But then I worry about whether or not a publication, a news outlet, should be responsible for how it makes other people feel.
Right.
And how, that you can't blame the people at Charlie Hebdo for the violent attacks. They're not the ones that perpetrated it, but I completely understand. And I'm right there with you in that these are things I would never feel comfortable saying. I would never feel comfortable attacking someone else's religion or their personal beliefs.
Yeah.
I think that though you have to look at the history, right? So it's one thing to initially attack or write a cartoon about Muhammad and to have the Muslim community, whether they speak out, whether they write the editor, or they do something as to us in the West would be barbaric as firebomb the place. It's like they already had a warning. It's like, we don't like that. We don't appreciate it. And to continue to do it, I think, is really pushing the envelope. And I'm kind of like where you are, right? Like, I don't want to be told what to do and what to say. But at the same time, I think that where we get lost is So two things. One, we don't respect other people's points of view and or their feelings or their religious beliefs. And two, there is a lack of understanding of what someone holds as sacred or what someone holds as dear and true to them. And when you're dealing with a group of people who have proven over and over and over again that they have no problem flying planes into buildings, they have no problem beheading people on YouTube and on national television, I just would say that you err on the side of caution, because it's not just you that's at effect here. You've got two police officers that had nothing to do with the printing of that publication that are dead. You have people in the Jewish market that are dead. You know, there's just so many things, and we just really need to treat people the way we want to be treated. Yeah. And we're also really not the community or the country that can be standing on our high horse, because
yeah,
in
certainly.
The name of democracy in America, we've been embalmed 150,000 or more Iraqis, you know, based on a lie. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I have to say, though, that I would have a little bit of a difficult time saying the limits of our free speech should be dictated by threats of violence.
Right. And the group of people we're referring to here is criminals.
Right. And I understand that the cartoon was a provocation, but I have a hard time saying that the cartoon, because the cartoon was published, 17 people are dead. There was an intervening group of actors in there.
Right.
So I understand.
Yeah, I do understand what you're saying,
yeah.
Right? I
mm-hmm.
get that. It's like when I'm talking to my son and my daughter, mm-hmm. if my son hits my daughter, it doesn't mean that it's okay for my daughter to hit him back. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that. And at the same time, I have to say, if we just treat people the way we want to be treated,
right.
I think that a lot of the violence and the stuff that we see, we wouldn't see. And I mean, my heart goes out to the families that have lost their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so being someone that is religious and I'm devout in my faith, when someone tells you that that offends them, I think we should listen. I don't think that they should die for it, you know, but I think that they should listen. And I don't think that the government should be the one to shut them down.
Right.
But then Muslims should get together and go, like you were saying before, go to the advertisers and say, well, we're not going to shop. Similar to what happened with Rush Limbaugh when he said what he said about Sandra Fluke.
Yeah.
We, as a group of women, we said, nope, we're not shopping, we're not doing this, we're not doing that. And that is how we can counter those kinds of messages
yep.
and the things that we don't like.
Yep, that's an excellent point.
I certainly agree. And Dennett, thank you very much for listening to Sirius and for the call. It's a very strong viewpoint that I saw all over the media when researching this, that we should be more careful with what we say. But I have to be honest that
yeah.
also as somebody who works in and practices journalism, that puts me in a very uncomfortable position where
yeah.
I feel like any threat to the things that we can say borders on somebody eventually saying that we're lawfully not allowed to say, you know, that,
yeah.
that something is against the law. And I know that that's a slippery slope argument. And,
right.
And I may be,
hypersensitive.
Yes.
I don't think that's a bad thing to be necessarily.
Not when it comes to freedom of expression.
No, no. And I think in a way she was saying that we do let the society, determine. We also should use our best judgment.
Right.
You know,
and I say all of that in, you know, protection of freedom of speech and freedom of expression, but emotionally,
yeah.
I have to say I'm right
yeah,
there.
And
with,
the cartoon is provocative, but so
right.
is, as Tom pointed out last week, so is our foreign policy
yeah.
for decades. So if you have something, a cartoon that's provocative and a foreign policy that's provocative, I'd err on the side of letting the free speech go forward and changing the foreign policy.
Right. And yeah, one of the things that I meant to ask Lee Camp about, and
yeah.
I forgot, is there's also a guideline in comedy, in satire, of joking up, that you can't
right.
really joke below your station. And attacking a group that, let's face it,
is
marginalized,
yeah.
Is treated like terrorists, may not be the most effective form of satire. But there's a lot of people who want to weigh in on this, and we're going to get to as many of them as we can. Lots more time in the show, so don't go anywhere. You're listening to Danielle and Shano, In for Tom.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Where do you weigh in on this? All opinions are accepted. Let's work this out together. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Let's go with Bob, watching online in Sherman Oaks, California. Bob, you had some thoughts on free speech and a little hypocrisy, correct?
Yeah, extreme hypocrisy. Our country is so secretive about the things that we should know. You're talking about free speech on cartoons that are, if it were placed against my heritage, Jews or blacks in this country, you would not be having this show.
Right.
You would not be having this show if the cartoons were about bad mouthing blacks or bad mouthing Jews. There would be nobody that would publish it, and you would not have 1.5 million people standing up for, or 3 million people in Paris standing up for the right. Now, here's a couple of things as a teacher I'd like to tell you, and that's we are the only country, maybe one other, and I can't remember, who has to say the Pledge of Allegiance every day in a classroom starting at age 4.
And the prayer before many sessions of local and state and federal lawmakers.
And at sporting events.
Yeah.
I have no idea why sporting events. I used, during the Vietnam War, I'm 76, during the Vietnam War, I sat down, and whether they're not going to get arrested for it, many people would have beat me and perhaps beat me to death for not standing up during the Star Spangled Banner at the Madison Square Garden. But we're the only, and that was a flag lobby that has our children saying a Pledge of Allegiance, standing with their hands over the hearts, standing and facing universal religious object in this country, which is the American flag. I would prefer, actually, even as a Jew, having Jesus, having people pray to, than to the American flag, because it brainwashes children. Now, as far as free speech in this country, we have just seen the worst form of not allowing free speech by the executive summary of what we did as torturers.
Yeah.
Where's the 3 million people standing up and saying, we want, it's our government, we want all 6,000 or 8,000 pages of it. Why do we, if we're so in favor of free speech that we're willing to go to Paris to march, aren't marching 3 million people in the street so that we can know what our government has done, that it breaks every treaty that we've ever signed, which is therefore constitutional law. I mean, I'm rambling a bit. I'm sorry about that. And as far as our textbooks go, it's really important that people know that there's one state that controls pretty much everything that goes into major textbooks in high school and to some degree college, and that is Texas. There are three major markets for textbooks: Florida, California, New York, and Texas. Texas has about 16 different groups to make sure that nothing anti-patriotic is ever put into a textbook.
Right.
Nothing versus capitalism. There's all these different people that have been doing it for 20, 30 years. Nothing that's anti-capitalism, anti-patriotic, anti-American, anti-any war that we've ever been.
Bob, this is a brilliant summary. I sincerely apologize about cutting you off, but absolutely brilliant summary of ways we are hypocritical when it comes to free speech. Thank you very much, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. Danielle and Shano sitting in today, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service and Victoria Jones, free-don.org. I think that's the current sponsor. Victoria, what's going on in the news today?
Well, I just came from the White House press briefing with spokesman Josh Earnest, who was asked right at the beginning of the briefing, or very close to the beginning of the briefing, about why there was not a higher profile presence yesterday at the march and rally to show unity in Paris after the massacre at Charlie Hebdo magazine and the attacks on the kosher supermarket on Friday. And he said that that it is fair to say that we should have sent someone with a higher profile.
Now, this talking point, this hysteria seemed to blow up in the media, that everybody was wondering why we didn't have a higher ranking official. However, it's also come out that that picture was completely staged. So had we sent Biden, had we sent the president himself, would they not be asking the question of why we sent them for a photo op?
They might be asking that question, but I don't think that it was entirely staged.
Okay.
I think that is possibly as much of a falsehood as the idea that the march was a complete march. I think the truth is probably
somewhere in the middle.
Between. Yeah.
As is usually the case.
Yeah, as is usually the case. But certainly, I think it was a little bit of a surprise to some reporters today that Josh Earnest just immediately out of the box said that it was fair to say that we should have sent someone with a higher profile. He went on to say that said, we stand four square with our allies in France, and talked about the kind of cooperation that's been going on, saying that cooperation continues today, saying, in fact, the French ambassador would be at the White House later this afternoon meeting with the counterterrorism advisor. And he said that had the circumstances been a little different, President Obama would have liked to be there. But it wasn't really, he said the planning had only started Friday night. It wasn't really clear. He still hasn't said why a higher profile person has not been able to go. So there are a lot of questions about that. A little bit more on this. The next edition of Charlie Hebdo magazine comes out on Wednesday with a million copy print run versus 60,000. It'll be translated into 16 languages. And it will, quote, naturally, unquote, contain cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, along with jibes against politicians and religions across the board. Richard Malka, the Weekly's lawyer, says that. He says, we will not give in, otherwise all this won't have meant anything. Humor without self-deprecation isn't humor. We mock ourselves, politicians, religions. It's a state of mind you need to have. So we had that.
Yeah, that will be interesting, and I presume maybe some of the revenue will help pay for the damages and the everything sustained in those attacks.
I would think they would hope, yeah. Also today, hackers claiming to be affiliated with ISIS militants apparently have hacked into the Twitter account for U.S. Central Command, that's CENTCOM, posting warnings to American troops and their families, as well as what appears to be general rosters with military personnel's addresses, emails, and phone numbers. Among those with information as posted was General Martin Dempsey, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Hackers have also posted maps, reportedly showing missile locations and notes labeled Korean scenarios and China scenarios. The hackers have written things like, ISIS is already here. We're in your PCs in each military base. We won't stop. We know everything about you, your wives and children. The hack occurred around 12:30 p.m. Eastern time.
Wow. Has any response come out on that? Any denials?
No denials. That was the first question for Josh Earnest. He said, obviously, you know, and this, he only spoke about this with, you know, within less than an hour of the hack taking place. He said, obviously, you know, it's only just happened. And, you know, so we're looking into it. Of course, you know, we're looking into it right now. He said, I would point out that there is a significant difference between a data breach and the hacking of a Twitter account, because a Twitter account, of course, is a private account.
Right.
So they didn't. He's saying that they didn't get into CENTCOM.
But then, presumably, where did they get all of this information? You know, military addresses, plans. If they're
well,
real,
that's
if
my
they're
question.
Not.
And yeah. And I've left the briefing, and I at the time that I left, nobody had actually asked that question. So if nobody's asked it, that's one of the questions I'm looking to ask.
Okay, well, we will wait on an update.
Yes. President Obama today at the Federal Trade Commission called for federal legislation to force American companies to be more forthcoming about credit card data. He proposed three laws today. The first one is a new federal standard dubbed the Personal Data Notification and Protection Act, and this would require companies to tell their customers within 30 days from the discovery of a data breach that their information has been compromised. As you know, hundreds of millions of records were stolen last year. Now, the problem with this is that some states have tougher standards than that. So they're not going to be pleased with it. But then other states don't have any standards at all. So it's a question of how do you fix the patchwork?
Hmm. Yeah, it's surprising that any state wouldn't require a company to share it with you if your information has been jeopardized.
Right, exactly. He also proposed the Student Data Privacy Act, which will prohibit tech companies from profiting from data collected on students in schools. That comes amid an increasing drive to bring technology to the classroom. And he said he's going to resurrect the Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights, which he announced during the last few months of his first term. This is a privacy bill which he's asked Congress to codify, and it aims to give Internet users the right to control what data is collected and how their data is shared.
See, it's great in theory, and hopefully something happens with that. It's the how something like that would be done that just makes my mind turn into a pretzel.
And this is why so many of these cybersecurity laws have failed in Congress.
Yeah. It's, you know, the power of the Internet sometimes can be a negative in and of itself. Victoria, thank you so much. And I look forward to hearing your update on that CENTCOM story. That's scary stuff.
Interesting. Thank you.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. We'll be back with more. You're watching the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Tom is out today, but Shano and me, Danielle, are filling in, taking your calls, getting your thoughts on Keystone, on free speech, Charlie Hebdo, and lots more stuff. And so I wanted to add one more topic in there, of course.
Yeah, you got to pile on.
Of course.
Yeah.
We don't have enough to talk about.
No.
This weekend, Governor Jerry Brown of California had an interview on CBS News in which he was asked, does Washington have some things to learn about how political problems have been solved here in California? Because let's face it, Jerry Brown walked into, you know, his second run at being California's governor when the state was kind of a mess.
It was.
But he has turned things around, created jobs. You know,
despite all the predictions, I mean, they voted in a tax increase on the wealthy, and then Fox News went around for weeks, I think. They may still be running it. I don't know.
Yes.
All the rich people are leaving. Straight out of Atlas Shrugged. Let's go find some uber wealthy or say they're going to move.
I think they found one.
They found one or two, yes.
Phil Mickelson. Mickelson.
I can't remember for sure, but perhaps.
I think it was him. Okay. I think. I could be wrong. Forgive me, Phil, if I am misstating.
Mr. Mickelson.
But
yeah.
He responded, in Washington, some people are afraid to pass a tax because it affects the economy. Well, we created a million jobs here with that new temporary tax, but we also cut. And we've made cuts that I think, even in Washington, they've been reluctant to do. Very well stated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe some Democrats in Washington, D.C. were listening. I think maybe they had this idea a little bit before.
Yeah, they didn't just come up with this morning.
If not, they're really fast writers.
Yeah, they are.
Yes, because Representative Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, as well as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and others, are pushing a new bill,
a tax reform
bill that, let's face it, shifts some money from those so-called job creators and puts it back into the hands of the middle class.
Right. It's a transaction tax,
right,
that would essentially target the uber wealthy, and it would be a huge tax cut for the middle class, tripling the child deduction, like $2,000 per year per couple, you know, a gigantic boost to our actual economy, not the trickle-down voodoo economics.
Right.
Following more in the Jerry Brown style of things rather than the Sam Brown back. So we have two, you know, sets of assumptions, and we've seen how they've played out. We have the California one, worked amazingly. Kansas, they're borrowing from their pension fund in order to cover their budget shortfall because voodoo economics didn't work there. Unfortunately, we have a Congress right now that's going with the Kansas route instead of the California route.
Right. How much more evidence do you need about what works before you stop rehashing the same policies and now instituting them in the actual rules?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very difficult to get anything except these disproven policies into action. Now, the Democrats are not foolish enough to think that they're going to pass this plan in a Republican-controlled Congress. But what they do recognize is that people are sick of the weak Democratic point. People are sick of the, you know, Republican and Republican light, that they want some big differences,
yeah,
that they tried these middle of the road tactics in the last election and it cost Democrats big.
And those that didn't take the middle of the road, those who had a strong progressive stand, won and won overwhelmingly.
Right. So they've obviously gotten that message, and the message that Jerry Brown will tell you in California works quite well, thank you very much, works well for the state, works well for the politician, and works out pretty well for the people and for the environment if the news out of his state is any indication, with them starting work on a new bullet train, moving to get 50% of their energy by renewables, as well as budget surpluses, not cutting pensions,
yeah,
things like that. So let's face it, the Democrats' plan is right now a position, a platform to show how they are different from Republicans. And I'm okay with that.
But unlike the Republicans last time, who just ran against, we're going to run for something.
Right. This,
I mean,
is
Thomas proposed
for
this, the shadow government. You know, this is kind of, if you just sat there and said, well, we're not going to put up any bills because they're going to get passed anyways, then next election time or whenever anything, it's hard to get behind anything if there's nothing there to get behind.
Right.
So I think it's important that they keep doing this over and over and support these bills. I don't care if they're not going to pass.
Me neither.
Maybe they will. Maybe there can be enough support, enough grassroots support. You never know.
Maybe you give people something to vote for instead of just having things to vote against.
Right. And that's why, you know, Senator Chuck Schumer comes out, it sounds a lot like Elizabeth Warren. These are big deals. These are big deal shifts.
And, you know, I'm from the South. Proudly, for the most part, except that whole racism thing. And there's an expression we love, go big or go home. And the Democrats are finally going big.
Yeah.
And I think that is a great thing. Nancy Pelosi herself, the challenge is a big one. You have to think big. You have to think forward and you have to think new. You have to think new and fresh. And those are words that I hope we're still hearing out of her mouth and out of Democratic leadership's mouth come 2016, where we're not putting up the same candidates. We're not putting the same pro-corporate policies. And yes, we're not afraid of things like moving the wealth from the 1% in the form of a transaction tax to the middle class. That,
it's been
we should not be afraid to say that.
It's been
those
happening things. In the opposite direction for decades.
Right.
Plus, you know, income inequality. You even have conservatives on the Sunday morning shows talking, at least talking about how they're concerned about this.
Yes, talking.
Yeah, it is.
Lots
it is a lot of talk.
Talk. Yeah, and their solution, put in more trickle down and institute it in the rules.
The question is in these 2 years, how do we get the conversation more towards the Jerry Brown way of running a government and away from the Sam Brownback?
How do we make
is that possible?
How do we make D.C. more like CA, more like California? How do we get the rest of Congress to stop being afraid of progressive policies and realize that going big is the right answer here, that we need big solutions because we have big problems? And things
like President Andrew Shepard and the American president. We have big problems.
Am I channeling my American president?
A little bit.
For all I know, I've seen it enough times, they could be
that's
exact lines.
Yes.
Anyhow, we'd like to get your thoughts on this as well. Of course, the Republicans will call it, you know,
wealth redistribution
and class warfare.
Class warfare, yes.
They've been waging the class warfare.
And they're winning.
It's time for a little defense, guys. So, as we like to say, go big or go home, and it's time to go big. Sure. And Democrats are listening. I think they got Jerry Brown's message.
Yeah, and while Elizabeth Warren, I take her at her word that she's not running for president, her coming out and making these bold speeches and the reception that they're getting amongst people is well, again, she's not running for president, is definitely moving the conversation in the right direction. And I'm so happy about that. And as more and more Democrats, like I said, Senator Schumer giving that speech, you know, proposing tax policies like this, Nancy Pelosi sounding like that, and say it loudly, say it often as well, which is a really important thing. The conservative media is gigantic, so we have to say it louder and more often because they've got their infrastructure. Ours is a little
right. And regardless of what you say, the conservative media, the conservative pundits are going to frame it however they want to make themselves look good. So at least say something that you can be proud of. Say something that people can stand with you and vote for. And things like, it's time to put a tax on Wall Street so that the middle class, working Americans can get a tax cut. Sounds like common sense to the vast majority of Americans.
Money that would be spent right away.
Right. So anyhow, just another topic for you to weigh in on. We'd love to know your thoughts. Shano and me, Danielle, sitting in for Tom today. And we're here for the rest of the show.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How do we make D.C. more like California? Is it a good idea? Bad idea? What do you think? Welcome back. Danielle and Shano here, sitting in for Tom today. Let's go with Paul in South Lyon, Michigan, watching on Free Speech TV. Paul, thanks for watching.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Danielle. Hey, you and Shane are doing a great job. You are two of the most brilliant people I know of.
Oh, not even close, especially not talking to you.
Please, go on.
Okay, stop. Anyway, a different Paul pointed out earlier that the Republicans are always dividing people. Remember Scott Walker caught saying, we're going to divide and conquer working people of Wisconsin. And they're always pitting white people against black people, gay people against straight people, women against men. You know the routine. But I want to talk about Keystone.
Okay.
And which not only will it help destroy the planet, it will raise our gas prices. Right now, most of the gas being produced in this continent is being sold here, which is only one of the reasons prices are so low right now. And this gas is being moved by truck and rail, creating jobs. If Keystone is built, it will become cheaper to send all this gas to the Gulf of Mexico to be exported to Europe and China, raising the price of gas here and destroying jobs at local refineries and truck drivers. And also, all Republicans voted in the House for the Keystone Pipeline, and around 80% of Democrats voted against it. So I hope this will be a lesson to, you know, progressives who are saying both parties are the same, you know, and the president is blocking it right now, blocking the Keystone Pipeline.
Right, and people who want to say that they're the same will probably focus in those 20-something, I looked it up, but the number escapes me, I think 23 or 28 Democrats that voted with Republicans to support Keystone, and I don't have to look at that list to know who they are, the, you know, the Mary Landrieu type Democrats. I'm not surprised by that anymore, but there are real progressives at work. There are people really working on real infrastructure projects. By the way, Bernie Sanders wants to propose a $1 trillion infrastructure project.
Talk about going big or going home.
Talk about jobs.
Yeah.
You're going to sit here and talk about a measly 42,000 jobs, which is a debunked number to begin with. You know, how many jobs would a $1 trillion infrastructure project create that, by the way, we desperately need?
Right, and you don't even need a trillion. I mean, I know he's going for a trillion, but if you even got 200 billion, that would virtually put all the unemployed people back to work, which is around actually, you know, 3 or 4 million right now. Even if you did a small version of what Bernie's suggesting, it would you know, put just about virtually everyone back to work and start to raise wages.
Yep. Right?
You know?
Well, there's a lot to consider in the economics of Keystone, Paul, and I know you are an economist, so thank you for sharing that with us. We certainly appreciate your genius and expertise, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Do we have time for one more
quickly?
Let's jump really quickly to Catherine watching in Madison, Wisconsin. Catherine, you had some Charlie Hebdo thoughts?
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
Well, yes, I think we're not looking at the bigger picture, which is right now in Europe, there is a lot of anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant sentiment, and that Charlie has really acted like the Ku Klux Klan or the Fox News in ginning that up.
Yeah.
They've been very racist. They've been very provocative. And it really hasn't been just for the sake of satire or anti-religion. There's a very big anti-Muslim sentiment and anti-immigrant in France. Muslims are in a
ghetto. Catherine, hang on one second. We'll continue this right after the break because didn't give you enough time to make your point there. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Tom is out today. Me and Shano filling in. If you want to chat with us, give us your feedback on Twitter, you can certainly do so. I am at Danielle on radio, and Shano is at Producer Shano. We cut Catherine off. Catherine, watching on Free Speech TV in Madison, Wisconsin, you were making a point about Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah, but Charlie Hebdo has been very racist. It's been very provocative in that it's been inciting anti-immigrant and anti-Jewish sentimentality and anti-Muslim sentimentality. It has been akin to Fox News or the Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
It has been that inflammatory. There are ghettos of Muslims in France. There is low, there is no jobs. Okay, all of that breeds young people being able to get caught up and have a cause and want to be connected to something and feel like they're doing something with their life. I'm not defending what they did.
Of course not.
But this is what's going on. You have a very pre-war Germany type of situation in all of Europe right now when it comes to anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim.
Well, I think, Catherine, just your opinion. I think, you know, we saw 3 million people. We saw 3 million people come out in France and march for unity. Don't you think we need more than a march? We need inclusion in society. We need economic opportunity. I mean, you can put this same discussion for the ghettos in Chicago. You can put them for
What was the unity really for? It wasn't unity with the Muslims and the immigrants. It was unity with the ability for them to be as racist as they want.
Right, and we need to move beyond that.
Well, but we have to look at history, and this is the way it started in pre-war Germany.
Yeah,
and I've been somewhat connected to the Jewish community, and for the last 10, 15 years, there have been a number of defacings and other things of synagogues in France
and here in the U.S. I mean, these are similarities.
Oh, yeah,
there's the hard truth of it is these are similarities. There are some parallels we can draw with our own country here in the topic that you're, you know, the points that you're making.
Parallels. I think it's the same billionaires behind it, and the same and Alec Exposed and all of those people are behind it. If you Google Karl Rove's campaign strategies. It'll come up with a Daily Kos article and a 54-page paper by Professor Silverblatt, which is strategies and counter-strategies. And you will see all the patterns that they delineated that they're promoting not only here, but they're promoting in Europe.
Nope.
I think it's an extremely important paper, an extremely important article. And all the things that people keep saying, they do this, they do that. Well, there are all these rules to do it. To support an adolescent worldview, a narcissistic worldview, a simplistic worldview. And it goes on and on and on. This is a coordinated plan.
Yeah, I think you're right, Catherine. And thank you very much for the point. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Madison. We do need to admit those truths. That's the only way we face the harder questions of how we even begin to discuss the free speech issue. I agree. Let's go with Norma in Montgomery, Alabama, watching on Free Speech TV as well. Norma, thanks so much for holding it. You've been holding for a while. I apologize there.
I knew you wouldn't forget me, Daniel. I wanted to go back to when the guy was talking about Social Security.
Paul in Woodinville, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What a lot of people don't understand is that there is a cap on income of where you no longer pay Social Security. You can pull this information up by just asking Google a simple question, what does a person pay in Social Security? And it will tell you the rate is 6.2%. And the cap is $113,000. So a person who makes $113,000 pays the same Social Security tax as a person who makes $1 million. Now, if you turn around and you pull up how much does Congress get paid, Boehner is paid $223,000. So that top $100,000 that we pay him, he does not pay Social Security tax on. So Bernie was talking a couple weeks ago about changing the cap. So how do you get Congress to raise the cap when they themselves will now start paying Social Security tax on 100% of their income?
Well, while I personally don't have any issue with somebody paying slightly more taxes after $113,000, it's an amount of money that I think most people, most families just can't even conceive. And so to say that you can't afford a few extra dollars out of your paycheck so that people like Paul or people on disability have enough to eat, I don't have a problem with that.
And also, I think, and I'm not speaking for Senator Sanders in any way, shape, or form here, I think he's talking more of a donut type of situation where you would stop, there would be a cap, but then there would be like a donut hole where you wouldn't have that tax, and then it would begin again starting in. He often throws out different numbers, but he says they're flexible, you know, 200 or 250,000 through infinity.
Right. So if you put it at something like 250,000, Norma, most people in Congress aren't going to be affected. It's going to be people who make even more money than Boehner and people in Congress, people who make $250,000 or more. And they're going to pay up to $113,700. They're going to pay exactly like they pay now. They're not going to pay anything on income between $113 and $250, and then anything above that. Whether they make $1 billion a year, those people are going to be asked to contribute so that individuals like Paul aren't asked to have their income cut by 20%.
And I know. And you see, I'm one of them.
Yeah.
Because I live off of disability Social Security myself. And if these people did pay more, if they were to, say, pay $14,000 a year, that is the total income of a person who works for Walmart here in Montgomery.
Right. That's.
And I don't think that they actually understand that, you know, if you're living in a poverty state, you know, to turn around and watch someone who is wealthy not willing to pay Social Security tax is rather infuriating.
It's a bit hard to swallow. Granted, I'm not in that tax bracket. So, you know, maybe I can't speak because I don't know. But I can't, even in the tax bracket I'm in now, I would happily pay a little bit more so that people don't have to choose whether or not they put a roof over their head or food on the table. That's not the kind of society I want to live in. So I think they should be asked to pay more. I think it's just inhumane and despicable that you start cutting the budget on the backs of the disabled.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
What do you think? Disabled? How is that Christian? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Shano and me, Danielle, sitting in for Tom today. Taking your calls on all sorts of interesting topics.
And the board is full.
Yes. Thank you.
I like that.
Thank you very much, listeners. We appreciate it.
Very much.
You guys are too kind. Let's go with Tony in Decatur, Georgia, listening on Sirius XM. Tony, you had some thoughts on religion and justification?
Yeah. I was listening to some of the comments about the shooting in Paris, and it seems like people who have a religious belief say on the one hand is objectionable to them shooting the people, but they don't, on the other hand, they say that there's a reason why they were angry. And my point of it is that there's no word anyone can say to you that offends you that gives you the right to kill anybody, and there should not be any mitigation of that belief. You do not, we live in a modern society. We're no longer doing duels because you offend my wife or religion or anything that I may believe in. The way you respond to an offense that someone gives you verbally is you respond verbally. You either do an article, you do an editorial, and if it's specifically about your belief in God, I don't understand how someone can kill someone because they upset or offended their God, as if their God, the person who created the universe, needs their help. So the whole concept, when you hear callers on your show and other shows say, well, I understand why the Muslim was angry, that to me is the wrong statement to be made, because there's no understanding of why these people was killed.
I understand the point you're making.
I think it's please don't confuse. I understand why someone was offended with. I understand why someone reacted that way. As you pointed out, no one has the right to not be offended, but equally, no one has the right, if offended, to kill as a result of it. And just because we're saying we can understand why someone might be offended by a cartoon, I imagine there's some cartoons that you may be able to be offended by, and you would not go out and shoot somebody. We are not condoning the reaction. But we can understand the provocation, not how far the reaction went. Does that make sense?
In a way, I would say no, because and you still, to me, when you say you understand the reaction, that's giving license to the reaction. The whole concept of you don't say things provocative, if that was the rule, we wouldn't have the civil rights movement, because people died by saying things they knew the society, people in society, would be upset about or be offended by.
Right.
We wouldn't have had the British movement. People, Medgar Evers would still be alive if he didn't say things that upset someone. There's people who listen to this show right now that may not be mentally stable. They can take anything out of context that you may say in defense of or belief of something, and all of a sudden come try to kill someone. That should never be any statement saying that they understand this reaction, or even...
I'm not saying that I understand this reaction. What I'm saying is I can understand that someone would be upset.
And I don't think any of the callers, at least none to my recollection, were saying that they understood the reaction, that they were understood being offended by certain portrayals of someone else's religion. And I do understand them being offended. Anybody who looking for a reason for violence, looking for a reason to attack another individual, is going to find a justification. Right now, they used these cartoons as a justification, but these are criminals. These are, terrorists, should you want to use that word. They would have found another justification regardless. But that is somewhat of a separate issue of whether or not we can be offended by a cartoon and still respect the fact that they have the right to draw it, the right to publish it, the right to offend us. I mean, these are all different parts of a much bigger discussion.
Yeah, in a modern society, though, you have to live with offense in a modern society.
Yes.
Right, but you can still admit to being offended.
Yes.
That's all we're admitting, is that someone could be offended. That's all we're saying. We're not saying that you can get so offended that you would go out and shoot somebody.
Yeah, but I think the problem is to admit that someone can be offended in the context of the conversation of the shooting occurring throws the wrong example to someone who may be on the fence and saying, well, maybe I shouldn't do it. Well, no, other people say now they give me justification because they understand why I'm offended. That's my point. I don't believe
And I can understand how you get to that point, just as I can understand other people being, you know, understanding how others are offended. There's a lot of range of emotion, of feelings, of opinions on these issues because it is such an important and thank you very much for the call. You know, it is such an important discussion, and it is so much a factor of, you know, especially in this country, how we got to the point we are in a democracy, how our country was formed is the right to speak out, the right to protest, the right to say things that other people may not like.
That it's necessary to speak out.
Right.
And say things that other people may not like. That is absolutely essential to our democracy.
Right. There's a great article by Sandeep Roy over at Alternet called Je suis Charlie. Forgive me if I mispronounce that. No, I'm really not Charlie Hebdo. Here's why. Which is a great breakdown of kind of what we're talking about here. But there's a great line in this article. In an ideal world, the response to a cartoon that offends should be another cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
The response to a book that offends should be not to read it. The response to a film that offends could be to boycott. But that's an ideal world.
Right. And it, all we're doing is recognizing that something... There is a group of people that may not like this other thing here.
And there's never justification.
Never.
For violence.
Never.
Never. But people who want to perpetrate these type of attacks are just going to find another reason. They're just going to find their own justification because they're not looking for a logical reason. They're looking for an excuse to commit violence. So, you know, there's a lot of important issues there. Let's go with Rick in Eagle Mountain, Utah. Watching Free Speech TV on Roku. Rick, you had a question about Social Security.
Yes, I do. Hey, Danielle, Shane, how are you doing?
Great.
We're doing well. Thank you.
I have my newly elected representative in my district, Mia Love, and I need to ask you a question, somebody, Shane. How do I go about contacting her office and using the right word, the right phrase to voice my disgust in what they're doing to the Social Security Disability Fund? I'm an SSDI recipient. I get $1,114 a month, and they, under their new plan, they want to cut 20%. That'll put me under $900.
Yeah.
I think you said it, first of all, perfectly right there. In order to get a hold of Mila, who's now a representative,
so
Danielle, you have the number there.
Yeah, the congressional switchboard number is 202-225-3121. 202-225-3121. And
you contact them and you say who you want to speak with. They will connect you to her office.
Right.
And it's best if you say, one, stick to one issue. You seem like you are going to do that. And two, be respectful, but say it just the way you did to us right here. I think that would come off perfectly to her staffers.
That it was very well said, just how you said it to us. And for somebody who doesn't know what to say, doesn't know how to frame the argument, look to organizations that you feel represent you well, whatever they may be. In Social Security, you have organizations like the ARC, like Social Security Works.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a different viewpoint, I'm sure there's organizations that that come very close to how you feel. And a lot of times they have sample letters. A lot of times you can send letters to your representatives right through their websites. There's a lot of great groups working on these issues that can help you specifically. I know the ARC is working on this Social Security Cuts Disability, ARC, ARC. Did that help at all, Rick?
Yeah, it does, but there's it's just, you know, these shills are paid by the wealthy and the corporations, and they basically, because I've contacted Jason Chaffetz, was our representative, passed. Mm-hmm. Jerry Madden to redistrict everything, so because Mia Love lost in 2012,
mm-hmm.
and then she come back and Matheson dropped out. He knew he was going to get beat, I assume. And it's just, you know, you can't get your word across to these people without them looking at the downtrodden and the people that need this. They're saying you guys are moochers, and we don't need to take care of you. But there's never a conversation about the corporate welfare and the wealthiest tax breaks. There's never a conversation. You never hear that. Other than Tom Hartman. I watch this show every day, have done for years, and I've called in. This is like second or third time I've called, but it's just, you know, and I've tried contacting the Democratic the Democrat office in Salt Lake City. I don't even get a return call from them people.
Well, but Rick, we got to keep trying. And I have no, I make no excuses for an organization that doesn't get back to its constituents. And we've had problems with our own representatives not getting back to us. So I know how frustrating
that can
be.
And talking up against a brick wall sometimes it feels like.
But,
we got to keep speaking.
And on this disability thing, I think one of the most important things that we can all do is share these personal stories.
Yes.
We talked to Norma in Alabama. We talked to Rick right now in Utah. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. These are real people who will be affected because of this decision. And they are just such a small, small fraction of the 11 million people who will be affected because of this decision by Republicans. Those are the stories that need to get out there. Those are the stories that need to shame Congress into fixing this. And Rick, you just told yours. Keep telling it, my friend. And I hope the people listening help you tell it. Maybe Mia Love isn't receptive. Maybe people listening can call their congressman and share your story as well. You're listening to me and Shano here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be right back with more.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
How can we get together and, you know, share those stories? Maybe for people in right-wing districts, we can do it for them. Welcome back to Free Speech TV, the Tom Hartman Program, here with me and Shano sitting in. Let's go with Michael in Imperial Beach, California, watching on DirecTV. Thanks for watching the Tom Hartman Program, Michael.
Hey, Danielle, Shano, Troy, and Jim. Can't forget Troy and Jim.
Troy and Jim are doing amazing work, as always.
Dig it. Okay, but wondering what y'all think about freedom of expression pertaining to clothing. I believe a little while ago, France actually outlawed women from wearing burkas. So sort of like when America was shocked when women started wearing bikinis and miniskirts, how do you all tie together freedom of expression, speech, cartoons, and clothing? What do y'all think? Thank you.
I think it's an important question because I was looking at this before the show. France, which right now 3 million people stood as
for freedom of expression.
Freedom of expression has laws on the books right now, barring women from. I know it's not a burqa. I've lost my place in all my show.
Hijab.
Mm-hmm. Barring women from wearing hijabs in public, which is a religious beyond freedom of expression. It's a religious expression, which we here in the United States would hold to the highest standard.
Right.
I don't know how you parse that.
You can't jibe the two.
Right.
You actually can't, unless there's certain situations in this country where you can't. For example, on a driver's license photo. Now, that's for safety reasons. There has to be, in our country, in the United States, when you're going to infringe on someone's religion, it's going to pass the highest, strictest scrutiny where it's got to be this really compelling governmental interest, and you have to do it, narrowly tailor the rule. Only on driver's license photos or, only in the situation. This seems like it's a very broad ban in France. I don't know how they justify it. I don't know enough about it. But on face value, it appears to be in contradiction to what people were marching for on the weekend.
Yeah. And I think that should cause some self-reflection in France, in any country that has such a disjointed policy that you claim freedom of expression, but yet freedom of expression only to those who express thoughts that are like yours.
Right. We have those types of rules in some of our schools, but that's a different situation completely.
Different situation for a school, different situation for requiring somebody to present a photo at a DMV. But in public, I think that there is some hypocrisy there.
I agree.
I think it is freedom of speech. And if you're going to protect freedom of speech and not be a dictatorship, I think you got to protect freedom of speech even when it makes you a little uncomfortable. Let's go with Scott.
Thank y'all.
Thank you. Let's go with.
Got to be real quick.
Real quick. Scott, you have a quick point on the march in France in Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi, Daniel. Danielle. Yes, I've been hearing a lot of stuff about why didn't Obama go to France? And to me, it doesn't seem like he had enough time to have security arrangements put in place to make the trip, first of all. And if he did make the trip, the Republicans would be all on him about the car trip.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
I think it's a darned if you do, darned if you don't. And I got to admit, I got sucked up into the hysteria over it and said, well, why wasn't somebody there?
Well, and Victoria Jones said that the White House press secretary admitted, yeah, we should have sent someone higher level.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the president, but someone higher level.
Yeah, and it still still kind of looked like a photo op to me. But maybe they were just posing after the march.
That was only a one snapshot in time. We don't know what happened
That's
after.
That's right. We were not there. But, Scott, I think it's an excellent point about the Secret Service. We'll be back with more. You're watching the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Me, Danielle, and Shano sitting in for Tom today. Tom is okay, and he will be back. But we're taking your calls in the meantime. Let's go with Carolyn in Chicago, listening on WCT. Carolyn, I think you have some excellent points that you gave Troy here.
Yes. First of all, the last caller who said something about the president, you know, this whole issue of certain lives more valuable than the other, 17 people got killed in mm-hmm. France. Horrible. 2,000 got killed in terror, and there was a bombing of the NAACP mm-hmm. in Colorado. I mean, are you driven by trying to change policy and react with leaders, or are you driven by the public wanting you to show up for a photo op? Number two, there are 196 countries. Only 40 people went, okay? So all leaders didn't show up.
Good point.
And the third thing is I have a close friend who worked for the American Embassy in Paris. Our ambassador was there.
As was Eric Holder.
Well, Eric Holder was not at the march. He was in the country.
No, okay. Eric Holder was there.
Yeah.
But also our ambassador, the highest person on the ground on a day-to-day basis in Paris and in France in that country. So the media tends to be much more media-driven than rational-driven, which is, first of all, Obama has a country of 350 million people to take care of. And here in this country, I would be willing to bet that more than 20 people died of gunshots across this country.
That's a good point. Good point.
So the point I really want to say is we ought to stop acting like certain lives are more valuable than the others. I don't care who died, the terrorists, the shooters, somebody was in pain as a loss of a loved one.
Yes.
And the reaction to, did it merit this type of reaction? Years ago, black folks got shot for looking at white folks, mm-hmm. or hung. So what does merit a reaction when you feel you've been wronged? And at the same point, what about the people we've had drones that drop things on young people who are at weddings and we didn't do it, but there was a terrorist attack in Pakistan where schoolboys were killed.
Yeah, Carolyn, I think it gets down to the point you made when you first came on the line here, and that's the value of any and every life. I think all of the problems that you're talking about is all get back to that.
Which is the media, and particularly Western media, tend to value European ancestry lives much more than anybody else.
Yes.
That's true.
I certainly
Absolutely.
Agree. The NAACP bombing, I could tell you, to give you an update, I have been watching that story. They've released a drawing of the suspect. Still, I haven't seen, and I may have missed it. We've been on the air now for 3 hours, but I haven't seen any report that it's specifically targeted as a hate crime. I could have missed it, so I apologize if I did. And the Boko Haram story, I am flabbergasted. CNN, I was just looking at the crawl there over on CNN before I picked up your call, and that is stunning, and hopefully that account is exaggerated, but I fear that it's not, and that is a true tragedy. So we will certainly look into that some more. But, Carolyn, I think you make some excellent, excellent points, important points about the value of human life. Let's go with Merlene in Morriston, Florida, watching on the Dish Network. Merlene, how are you today?
I'm great. I'm going to be better. You're looking good, Danielle.
Thank
Happy
you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. You had some thoughts on how bills should be handled in the House and Senate.
Yes, both houses should, when the bill is passed and voted on, those bills should be put in a safe or someplace where no one going by can add their little notes to it, you know, or something they thought got left out, because no one ever seems to know who put that in the bill.
Yeah, I'm starting to think
that
every
amendment,
every single rider should have to require a name. Like it shouldn't just be
thumbprint.
You know, right, it shouldn't just be this anonymous rider in the bill. It should be, and I'm picking a name out of thin air, actually indicating any lawmaker, but like the Johnson rider that tells exactly who put it there.
Right.
Absolutely. That should be required, but I would still like to see those bills secured, because you can change a writing of something the way to make it different from what it was voted on. I just can't believe that the government is so lax in handling these bills and the manner in which they do.
The bills go into the congressional record, and therefore are that day are all put, you know, into print, and therefore you can take, if someone were to change it in the meantime, you would go back and compare the two and say, hey, something's going on here.
But how do you compare it before it ends up to law?
You don't.
You know, especially when you have a 6,000-page
oh, sure.
bill.
Well, we look at the post office funding its retirement account, and we still can't say with certainty who put that rider into that
right.
bill.
Right.
You know, years later, we still don't know for sure. There are some rumors here and there, but nobody really knows.
It's a stunning process that things like this can become law without anybody ever having to claim it. There have been so many great points, so many good calls today, and there are so many people still left on the board. Thank you, Merlene, and sorry to people we didn't get to. We will be back.
Yeah.
So we can talk about it tomorrow.
Sure.
Yeah.
And Tom, no conspiracy theories. Tom is just fine.
Yes, no conspiracy theories.
He will explain everything.
And lots of
interesting
stuff.
We just want to steal his thunder.
Lots of interesting stuff to talk about tomorrow, including possibly a redefinition of the term traditional family. Something mm-hmm. to think about. Shano and Danielle sitting in today. We appreciate you sticking around with us. Thanks to Sean, to Jim, to Troy, to, of course, Tom and Louise. And thanks to you. We'll be back tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.